At the very heart of the Gospel of John is a multi-chapter section, begins in chapter 13, ends in at the end of chapter 17, called we call it the Last Discourse. And in it, Jesus prepares his disciples for life after he has ascended to heaven. One of the key chapters is chapter 16. If you turn to chapter 16 of the book of John, page 1047 in the Pew Bibles. I'm going to read just a few verses of this, but you might look at the very first verse just to get a context here. Jesus says to his disciples, "All this I have told you so that you will not fall away." In other words, the whole last discourse is a preparation for the difficulties which are going to come, and then he talks about some of those difficulties. And then pick it up in verse 12. "I have much more to say to you, more than you can now bear. But when He, the Spirit of truth, comes, He will guide you into all the truth. He will not speak on His own. He'll only speak what He hears, and He'll only tell you what is yet to come. He will glorify Me, bring Me honor, because it is from Me that He will receive what He will make known to you. All that belongs to the Father is Mine. That's why I said the Spirit will receive from Me what He will make known to you." This is the gospel of Jesus Christ. Thanks be to God. Now keep your fingers in your Bible, and we're going to come back to this passage, and we're going to go on to another passage from 1 Corinthians in a moment. But I want to start off with a definition of wisdom. We've been talking about wisdom now a number of weeks. We will continue to talk about wisdom at least through the end of June. And as we do, I want us to be clear about what wisdom is. What is the definition of wisdom? It always seems to me that wisdom has two parts. The first part is knowledge. And often the book of Proverbs talks about things you need to know. It's not scientific knowledge, of course. It's a kind of savvy. It's a knowledge of the way things work, the way the world works. If you want to be wise, you need to know the way people are. You need to know the way money works. You need to know how best to do things. You need a certain amount of knowledge. But knowledge is not wisdom. It's not enough. You can be knowledgeable and not wise. You need, along with the knowledge, skill. The skill to be able to take the knowledge and put it into practice. The biblical word, the word for wisdom, chokmah, is the biblical word, the Old Testament word. It means something a little broader than our word for wisdom. You can use chokmah for kinds of things which we wouldn't necessarily call wisdom. There's an example of that in the book of Exodus, often cited as the first wise person in the Bible. In Exodus 35, it's talking about the preparations for the building of the tabernacle. And so, this is the end of chapter 35 of Exodus. Moses said to the Israelites, "See, the Lord has chosen Bezalel, the son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and has filled him with the Spirit of God and with wisdom, with chokmah, with understanding, with knowledge, and all kinds of skills to make artistic designs." And then he talks about all the different things that this craftsman is going to do. In biblical sense, you can be wise in a lot of different things. You can be wise in being able to build something, be able to do. You can be wise in business. You can be wise in all kinds of different practices. What it requires is knowledge and skill. That makes wisdom very different from something else that the Bible often talks about, which is law. Law is all about what ought to be. So when you read the Ten Commandments, these are things that ought to be the case in the community of God, right? That's what the Ten Commandments are about. But wisdom is not about what ought to be so much as what is, what's in fact happening, what the world is like, what the rules of the game are, in a sense. You could take the example of the passage that Coy preached on a couple of weeks ago, Proverbs 20, verse 7, which says that you should lead a blameless life. If you lead a blameless life, your children will be blessed. There's a kind of lawfulness about the relationship, right? I mean, if you lead a blameless life, then your children will be blessed. That's the way things are put together. And so, If you understand that, you have to not only understand the relationship, but then you have to have the skill to be able to lead the kind of life which is described as blameless, so that in fact your children are going to grow up the way that they ought to grow up. Now all of that is important. We need that kind of wisdom. We need to understand the world. We need to be wise as serpents, Jesus said, as well as harmless as doves. But it's not what I'm going to talk about this morning. We're going to go on. We're going to talk a lot more about this, that kind of wisdom. Let's call that wisdom of the world, or wisdom, maybe it would be more accurate to call it wisdom about the world. We're going to talk about, next week, Pete's going to talk about friendship. And then the week after that, Dillian's going to talk about how you use your tongue, you know, wisdom in speaking. I'm going to talk about wisdom in money and wisdom in business and wisdom in dealing with authority. All of those are very practical kinds of things having to do with this world. So let's call that wisdom of this world. But you can't understand everything that the Bible has to say about wisdom unless you understand there is another kind of wisdom. A wisdom which is not of this world. And Paul speaks of that, and now you can open to that passage, 1 Corinthians 2, beginning in the very first verse. And so it was with me, brothers and sisters, says Paul. When I came to you, I didn't come with eloquence or human wisdom, as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God, for I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. I came to you in weakness and with great fear and trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise or persuasive words in the sense of wisdom of the world, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom but on God's power. We do, however, speak a message of wisdom among the mature, but not the wisdom of this age or the rulers of this age who are coming to nothing. No, we declare God's wisdom, a mystery that has been hidden, that God is destined for our glory before time began. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. I love this passage, and I love it in part because what Paul's talking about here is people having difficulty with his preaching. They struggled with his preaching. They liked Apollos. You know, Apollos had been there for a little while. I don't know how long, but Apollos was apparently eloquent. Maybe Apollos was a popular preacher. And then Paul comes, and they're not so happy about Paul. They think that part of the trouble with Paul is that he's too hard. He's too difficult. And what Paul's saying here is, well, you know, there's two kinds of wisdom. There's the kind of wisdom you can speak of in simple words, and then there's this other kind of wisdom, which is a little harder to get at, and he says, that's the kind of wisdom I'm trying to get. I want to preach Christ and Him crucified. I want to point to something that's hard to get across, hard to understand. You read the letters of Paul, you know. You read Peter says, the letters of Paul are great for instruction. There are lots of things to be learned there, but they're hard. And ever since then, every commentator on the letters of Paul has picked that up and said, that's true. Paul's letters are hard because what he's talking about is a little hard to grasp sometimes. It's out of our experience. It's a wisdom not of this world. A number of years ago, quite a few years ago now, I was at an academic conference, and one of these huge academic conferences, thousands of people there, divided into lots of different sections, and in one particular section, the one that I was attending, was on the book of Jeremiah. And the way it was set up, it was kind of interesting, was they had invited a lot of senior scholars who had written commentaries on the book of Jeremiah, and then they invited younger scholars in to review and to criticize those commentaries, so that the younger scholar would read a review of the commentary, and then the senior scholar could respond to whatever it was the younger scholar had said. Well, because these senior scholars were there, there were lots of people. The room was packed. There were people sitting on the floor. There were people up and down the aisles. There was no room in that room at all. And one of the reasons was because Walter Brueggemann was there, and Walter Brueggemann is probably the best-known, most popular Old Testament scholar of our time. And Brueggemann's written a commentary on Jeremiah, a very fine commentary on Jeremiah. And so the younger scholar began to talk about his commentary and about Jeremiah, and she went on and on about how hard Jeremiah is, and about the fact that Jeremiah is kind of, you know, the Greek is different from the Hebrew, and trying to sort it all out is very difficult. And she wondered whether, you could really do a coherent commentary on Jeremiah, and she wasn't at all sure that Brueggemann had succeeded in doing this. So, of course, we're all kind of anticipating, now what's Brueggemann going to say? So he stands up, and he's always gracious, and he praised her for her words and said she's right about a lot of that and so forth. And then he said, you know, Jeremiah is difficult. And the reason why it's so difficult is because the main character of Jeremiah is so difficult. And then he did something that no one expected. It was an academic conference, remember. Nobody ever mentions God. They may talk about the Bible, but they never talk about God. He said, and the main character of the book of Jeremiah is Jeremiah's God. And there was this stunned moment of silence. Because Brueggemann had recognized what everybody really is there for, even if they don't admit it. Because we're puzzled by this God, this God who is so great, this God who is so far beyond our thinking, this God who is so much grander than what we are that we can't understand this God, this God who we can only get at in small and partial ways. And there was this moment of silence. And then the whole room broke into spontaneous applause. I was thinking about that when I read this little section of Paul. What Paul's saying is you need another kind of wisdom. It's the sort of wisdom that Jesus is speaking of in that passage that I read earlier from the Gospel of John, John chapter 16. In John 16, Jesus talks about the Spirit. Jesus, you know, came through the world like a comet, like a meteor. And everywhere he went, he left behind sparks of divinity. People were taken with him. They realized that there was power that he had that other people didn't have, power of healing. That they attended to his words. They realized that his words were powerful in ways that other people's words weren't powerful. They watched in amazement at his actions, what he did, the way he comported himself in the world. And then he was gone. He died, he rose, and he ascended. He was gone. Now they had to puzzle it out. Who was this person? What was this comet that came blazing through this moment in history in really almost compacted down to 3 years, maybe not even 3 full years? But Jesus was already ahead of them, he said. He said, there's a lot that I have to tell you that you can't yet hear. But I'm going to send to you my Spirit. And so the Spirit is the wind, right? The wind which carries the words of Jesus from heaven, from the right hand of God where Jesus is seated now, from the lips of Jesus, the words of Jesus come on the wind. They're blown on the wind of the Spirit directly to the community, directly to our hearts. And that's how we hear the wisdom which is not of this world. So what kind of wisdom is this? Well, it's really not a new word. A lot of people make that mistake. They think that, you know, when it says here that the Spirit will lead us into all truth, we think, well, then that must mean that someplace down the line someone's going to get a brand new revelation, it's going to change everything. No, that's never the way it works. It's always a new meaning for an old word. I was thinking about Isaiah 53. You know, if you think about Isaiah 53, you think about, you know the passage. It goes, who has believed our message? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before us like a tender shoot, like a root out of dry ground. I just love to read this thing. He had no beauty or majesty to attract him to us, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by others, a man of suffering, familiar with pain. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. He was pierced for our transgression. I could go on. Who's that about? If you read it 500 years before the time of Jesus, if you heard the prophet recite it 500 years before the time of Jesus, what would you have thought? Who's he talking about? Maybe about Israel. Israel kind of as the suffering servant. The people together. Is Israel suffering? Or maybe about some prophet who had in some way suffered something like this. Maybe Isaiah himself. But when we read it, we hear Jesus. We know that this passage echoes the life of Jesus. It's an old word, but it takes on new meaning. It's a little like what happens to us when we're children. You know, our parents say to us, "Someday you're going to understand this," and we say, no, you know, my parent just is a fuddy-duddy. My parent has no idea what's going on. And then you get to be a certain age, you know. Usually you get to be just old enough to be a parent. And one day you say to yourself, "You know what? Dad was right." Or "Mom was right." And suddenly their words have a whole new sense and a whole new meaning. Look at the word at the very end of chapter 16. Of the Gospel of John. Jesus says, "I've told you these things." This is just before he goes into a prayer. "I've told you these things," all these things, "so that you may have peace," shalom, well-being. "In this world you will have trouble. But take heart, I've overcome the world." When do you discover the meaning of that? It's when you have trouble, isn't it? I mean, you can read that passage 100 times. It doesn't mean much of anything at all. And then one day, you have real trouble in your life. And you're in the middle of the trouble, and in the middle of the trouble, I mean, Christians testify to this over and over again. This is a testimony of so many different Christians over all the ages, that it's in the trouble, it's in the middle of the trouble that you meet Jesus in a way that you never met him before. And you realize that the troubles are somehow bathed in something larger, something more significant, in the power and the lordship of Jesus Christ, in that regardless of what happens, you belong to Jesus. You hear on the wind Jesus saying, "I have overcome the world." He's talking here about resurrection, isn't he? He's talking about resurrection. What it's saying is that the resurrection of Jesus isn't just Jesus' resurrection, it's my resurrection. The life that Jesus has is not just my life, it's not just Jesus' life, it's my life. Think about what the theme of the New Testament is. What's the theme? Well, I mean, the theme is Jesus, but beyond that, one of the themes, isn't it, in the New Testament is belonging. That you belong to something larger than this world. Is not this true? I mean, you belong to a lot of things. You belong to a family. We're talking a little about this last night. You belong to a family. Your family may be functional, dysfunctional. Your family may bring certain things to you. So you belong to that family, and that may occasion you difficulty or not, and whatever. You belong to a certain social economic stratum. You have a job, you belong to the job. You belong to a race. That's the way our world arranges things. You belong to a whole lot of other things. What the New Testament says over and over again is that none of those things matter. None of them matter. What matters is that you belong to a world which is, you belong to a kingdom which is larger. You belong to a Lord who is larger than this, than all the rulers of this world. You belong to something which is beginning to take place and that one day will take place. Just this week, we have been reading N.T. Wright's book, Simply Christian. And we're on a chapter in which Wright's talking, very characteristically of Wright, he's talking about how heaven and earth interlock. They're not the same thing, but they interlock, and the distance between them is not large. The curtain between heaven and earth is not large. And then one day the curtain will come down, and when the curtain comes down, it will no longer be heaven and earth. It'll all be one thing. Earth will come to heaven, and heaven will come to earth. You know, this is all over in the New Testament, and it will all be one. Now, when you think about that, what it means is that as we live in this world, we are part of something which is being birthed, which is larger than anything else in our world. You may have trouble in this world, but Jesus says, I have overcome this world. This new reality is coming into existence, and you belong to it. The analogy that comes to my mind is playing a game. You know, you can pick out your own game, whatever it is. You may play soccer, or you may play cards, or whatever, Scrabble, I don't care. For me, it's tennis. That's my image, so I'll use that. You're playing tennis, and it's an intense game. You're really in the middle of it, and you're playing hard, and you're focused on it. And tennis has certain rules, and you got to know the rules, and you need wisdom for it, right? You need wisdom for it. You need not only knowledge, but you need skill. I played for a long time with Stan Drobak, who coached tennis here at MSU for 30-some years. And Stan had a zillion little sayings, all of which all of us know now, like, it isn't how hard you hit it, it's where you hit it. And there's a whole lot of these little things. That's just sort of wisdom about the game. Okay? The one who hits down wins the point. I mean, I could go on and on with this. That's like life. You play the game. You play it hard. You get involved in it. But if you get too involved in it, you start to forget that you're part of something larger. And you begin to imperil it. Years ago, Adrian and I used to play mixed doubles with a couple, best friends of ours. And we would always, you know, separate the spouses. So I played with my friend's wife, and Adria played with my friend. And we did so in part because it saved the peace between spouses. You know, we were trying to preserve the marriages here, right? And the woman that I played with, a good friend of mine, is very competitive. And I realized, I mean, there's certain rules to this game. I realized that I could fool around for so long, and then I had to win. And if I didn't win, I was in trouble. But at least I was in trouble, and I could go home with Adri. I didn't have to go home with her, right? Sometimes we get so involved in the game of life that we forget that there's something larger. We begin to cheat and gouge and scratch and do everything we can to get ahead. I mean, because we think, if I don't win this game, I've lost everything. If I don't win here, everything, I'm a loser. I don't belong to it. And then we have to hear the wind coming and say, this game is not the whole thing. You belong to something larger. Friendship, in the case of that tennis game, friendship is more important. Love is more important than the game. Belonging to Jesus Christ is more important than winning, whatever the world means by winning. So as much as we want to think about the wisdom of this world, we need always to remind ourselves that there is another wisdom, a wisdom not of this world, a greater wisdom. And one day that wisdom will be the whole game. Will you pray with me? Lord Jesus, send us your Spirit today. Send the voice of your Spirit. Remind us of all the things that you have said. Remind us, Lord, that as you speak across the distance between heaven and earth, that one day they will be the same. In Jesus' name, amen.